Good afternoon and welcome to Radio Astina for Tuesday, December 2nd, Year of Our Lord, 2008. I'm your host, Alex P. Linder, and what we're going to do today is finish with our discussion of the rise of mass testing in the U.S. Discussion of an article from Culture Wars magazine, October 2008 issue. And we'll get to that in a moment. First, I want to say that we're going to do a new paper coming from VNN and going out to thousands of people around the country, and we're going to be settling on the editorial in the next few days here. And if you go to VNNforum.com, you can find the thread in the general discussion section. Rounder will be managing it, Joseph will be laying it out, and I'll be doing the writing and the arranging. The editing, that is. Now, I see we're talking about what to call it. Probably we should call it either the White Alternative or simply The Alternative. Before, we've called it The Aryan Alternative and had another name or two. But I'll be mentioning that more tonight in the forum. Now, let's jump ahead and talk about the article. And we'll run until we're done discussing this. I don't know, maybe an hour, hour and a half today. And what we've been talking about here in the last two Radio Astinas is the way that the elite in America sought to bring about changes and rake the geniuses from the rabble by means of standardized testing, which arose over the course of the 20th century. as we had the development of the, you know, the theory of IQ and the first mass test applied to Army recruits for World War I and then in World War II, and then the rise, as we're going to see today, of behaviorism also. What the elite wanted to do was essentially stifle independent intellection, stifle independent minds, and introduce mass conformity so that the people who were produced by the school system would be cogs fit for the giant bureaucratized machine that America was becoming. And the principal writers you want to read on this are Charlotte Iserbyt, I-S-E-R-B-Y-T, whose book, The Deliberate Dummy Down of America, is available online. And you can also find that through links at vnnforum.com. We have a special subsection for online books. Another main writer in this regard is John Taylor Gatto, whose Underground History of American Education is a result of his decades of teaching in the New York City school system. And coming to reach conclusions about what the elite were actually trying to do in light of the policies and just the way that school is conducted. So, let's continue with that today. E. Michael Jones' article again in October 2008, issue of Culture Wars. Jones says, once they realized that the racial theories of people like Professor Gesell and Madison Grant were ultimately self-defeating as a mass ideology, the Rockefellers shifted their support to John B. Watson and behaviorism. When John B. Watson ran off with one of his graduate assistants and lost his job at Johns Hopkins University, that's the one in Baltimore, of course, the Rockefellers found his successor in an entomologist, a beetle scientist, that is, from Indiana University by the name of Alfred Kinsey. You know, Kinsey, along with Dewey, are a couple of the main WASP fronts for the Jews bent on controlling the mass white populations of the country and infecting them with Jewish nostrums, false ideas, bad fake medicine, that is what a nostrum is. When Kinsey became a liability at around the time of the Reese Committee hearings, which began in 1954, the Rockefellers abandoned him and began promoting Watson's true heir, B.F. Skinner. He was a behaviorist. He believed that humans, like other animals, could be simply conditioned. If you provided the right stimulus, you could guarantee the correct response. So no notion of free will or independent valuations of things. Humans will respond. You just have to give them the right incentive and they'll do what you want. You can scientifically manage people. What all these men had in common was the belief that the child was an empty vessel and that they had been ordained by God or the Rockefeller Foundation to fill that vessel as their plutocrat backers saw fit. Plutocrats are the very rich, or the extreme rich running society, or like oligarchs. The idea had an English pedigree, deriving from the Whig propagandist John Locke, who wrote in his Essay Concerning Human Understanding, which is still widely assigned in high schools and colleges. Let us suppose the mind to be, as we say, white paper, void of all characters, without any ideas. How comes it to be furnished? To this I answer in one word, from experience, in that all our knowledge is founded, and from that it ultimately derives itself. Taking his cue from the same source, John B. Watson wrote in 1930, "Give me a dozen healthy, well infants, well formed, in my own specified world to bring them up in, and I'll guarantee to take any one at random and train him to become any type of specialist I might select. Doctor, lawyer, artist, merchant, chief, and yes, even beggar man and thief, regardless of his talents, his penchants, tendencies, abilities, vocations, and race of his ancestors." Now that is utterly ridiculous. Dogmatically religious for a scientist. The same but that was what the elite believed. They could take anyone from anywhere and train them into becoming exactly what they wanted. Race didn't matter. Background didn't matter. Inherent abilities didn't matter. The same professors whose studies, quote, supplied evidence that quality was innate to the powerful, unquote, produced another contradictory body of evidence which showed that, quote, human nature was empty to the rest of us, unquote. Flush with Rockefeller money, the General Education Board of the Rockefeller Foundation established goals for the nation's public schools, goals which indicated that, one, there was a clear intention to reduce mass critical intelligence while supporting infinite specialization. Remember what we said. And two, there is a clear intention to weaken parental influence. And three, there is a clear intention to overthrow accepted custom. So they're going to change things around and build a world to their specifications and their liking. And they're going to do that, as we saw in last week's show, by submitting 95% of the people to low-level education, then 4% to specialized training, and then 1% alone are allowed true intellectual education that teaches them to see patterns and holes so that they can do the strategic thinking and provide the leadership for society, as opposed to the old system where parents educated their kids to the best of their ability at home or using private tutors, and they actually taught them how to think and they taught them the correct way to learn to read. The progressives and the people we're talking about now deliberately installed a false way of teaching in order to shear minds at the roots, prevent them from developing the skills needed to decipher English, new English words, and thereby have a multiplier effect of allowing them to teach themselves in whatever particular area their thoughts or their interests or their occupations led them. So that combined with the seduction of their minds through the provision of pornography and bogus ideas about self-esteem undercut the minds and the characters of the mass of the American people, so that you see around you today what is in fact the result, the intentional result of the elite of society. They only believe things that are good for the Jews, and there's a very great suspicion of any kind of general thought. In 1954, 1 year after James Conant had retired from his position as president of Harvard University, Carol Reese, R-E-E-C-E, congressman from Tennessee, opened hearings on the effect of tax-exempt foundations on American life. Reese devoted much of his attention to Alfred Kinsey's use of Rockefeller money to undermine the sexual morals of their fellow Americans, but he was handicapped by lack of inside knowledge about the extent of Kinsey's effort, largely because of the propaganda barrage that surrounded the publication of the Kinsey reports. Remember, these are the reports put out by this former entomologist, Alfred Kinsey, and they were sexual studies, studies of the sexual behavior of the population, and they were presented in the report as shocking revelations about what average people were really up to, even though the reports themselves were based on the self-reported sexual behavior of perverts, deviants, and prisoners, or both at the same time. And they used this false basis in order to undermine public morality by claiming that everyone was doing all these things that in fact everyone wasn't doing. But they did this with an agenda, which I've described earlier in the show. Kinsey's studies were largely a front for his homosexual obsessions, but the media insisted on portraying him as a straight arrow from Indiana, perhaps because every reporter who wrote about Kinsey had to give the professor his sexual history, which could later be used as blackmail if the reporter decided to write something unflattering. And again, this journal writing goes back, as we've seen in earlier Radio Westinas, to the Illuminati and Adam Weishaupt, and a perversion of the Jesuit doctrine of studying the small signs in order to know the initiates or the person you intend to control's character. By studying the small signs, encouraging him to write monthly reports or journals as they do in public schools, they get to know your innermost thoughts. They get to know what your parents are teaching you. They get to know what you believe, and they can use all that information to control you. They can use it against your own will. So different variations on a theme are what we see from politics and from in education and in other areas. We see the left and the Jews attempting to control average normal people while they're undermining them and undercutting their possibilities. The effect that Rockefeller money had on education was easier to discover, and Reese spent a large amount of the hearings denouncing elements of thought control and invisible coercion in the social sciences, which were largely a creation of Rockefeller money. In fact, such a concentration of foundation power in the U.S. operating in education and the social sciences, with a gigantic aggregate of capital and income, has come to exercise a very extensive practical control over social science and education. That's a direct quote. Foundation money, using science of the sort Kinsey promoted as its front, promoted moral relativity to the detriment of our basic moral, religious, and governmental principles. It also promoted, quote, the concept of social engineering, which is to say the belief that foundation-approved social scientists alone are capable of guiding us into better ways of living, substituting synthetic principles for fundamental principles of action. So turn everything over to the expert. Don't think yourself. Self-esteem, self-help, all this stuff comes from social scientists backed by foundation money or by tax money. The foundations use their money and influence to induce the educator to become an agent for social change. And that's what you see anywhere that you touch upon the subject of the New World Order. You see the teachers' colleges teach their charges, that is the education majors who go on to teach in the public schools, to become agents of change. And they're taught, Charlotte Isserbate has video segments on this you can find on the web and also through bnnforum.com. And what they do is they're trying to create a new world order in which race, nation, etc. don't matter except for the Jews. The Jews, are, as the main architects of this new world order, are allowed to maintain their own ethnic group, their ethnic loyalty, and advance their own ethnic agenda, whereas the rest of us are supposed to be folded in together. The whites, the blacks, the Mexicans, the Asians, etc. are supposed to be folded in together and disappear in the new tan universal man. That's the aim of the people who are creating the New World Order. And they do this by training the trainers and training the teachers, training them that they're to become change agents for this New World Order and making these low-level intelligences feel important as part of this giant scheme for change. And they have to identify resistors among the parents and shout them down and tell them that, you know, they're the only ones who are objecting, and so fool and trick the people even while they undermine their own children. This is what is going on. Again, the foundations use their money and influence to induce the educator to become an agent for social change and a propagandist for the development of our society in the direction of some form of collectivism. Man was a machine, and the Rockefellers could control that machine by controlling men's behavior, according to the program prescribed by Watson and Skinner, as implemented by the nation's public schools, and that is conditioning. Given the right stimuluses, they will provide the right responses. Says Jones, by the time my wife got hired as a teacher in Philadelphia's public school system in the early 70s, Skinnerian behavior modification was the rule. The way to get Negro children to behave like human beings was to treat them like rats. M&Ms for every correct answer. But if that were the principle, why not a much more radical application? Why not cocaine and electric shocks to the genitals? What tenet of Watsonian or Skinnerian behaviorism prohibited this sort of application of their principles? John Taylor Gatto had been teaching in the New York school system for 10 years by the time my wife showed up at the Mary McLeod Bethune School in North Philadelphia. During his tenure in New York, Gatto had seen behaviorism flow, and behaviorism is Skinner's ideology. During his tenure in New York, Gatto had seen behaviorism flow, and this is a quote from Gatto, like poison syrup into every nook and cranny of the economy, into advertising, public relations, packaging, radio, press, television in its dramatic programming, news programming, and public affairs shows, into military training, psychological warfare, and intelligence operations. But while all this was going on, selected tendrils from the same behavior crusade snaked into the Federal Bureau of Education, state education departments, teacher training institutions, think tanks, and foundations. The prize? Colonization of the young before they had an opportunity to develop resistance. The holy grail of market research. It seems like I saw an article just the other day talking about how they're not even focused on young adults anymore. They're more focused on teens and tweens or 20s. teens and 20s, because the older people have their mark choices, the choice of what they'll buy, what products they'll use are already pretty secure, so they're less likely to change. So the game becomes to get the young at an increasingly early age, get them onto the track of buying your products. Therapeutic thinking in matters educational reached a new level of influence in 1962 when the National Institute of Mental Health issued a report entitled The Role of Schools in Mental Health. 1962 report. Riding the wave of faith in science that broke over America in the aftermath of World War II, the NIMH, National Institute of Mental Health, got the federal government to fund a massive 5-year-long study of the mental health of the nation. Not surprisingly, that study discovered that Americans were in urgent need of mental health services. Equally unsurprising was the fact that they recommended the public school curriculum as one delivery system for those services. School curricula across the country should be designed to promote mental health as an instrument for social progress and as a means of altering culture. In The Role of Schools in Mental Health, a report issued in 1962, the NIMH was chillingly frank in the role they foresaw for the nation's schools. Education does not mean, and this is a direct quote, education does not mean teaching people to know. It means teaching them to behave as they do not behave. By 1973, Harvard psychiatrist Chester M. Pierce had concluded that, quote, every child entering school at the age of 5 is mentally ill, because he comes to school with certain allegiances to our founding fathers, toward our elected officials, toward his parents, toward a belief in a supreme being, and toward the sovereignty of this nation as a separate entity. It's up to you as teachers to make all these sick children well by creating the international child of the future. And this would be the New World Order. Training the children to become cogs in the New World Order by getting them to abandon all idea of God, king, and country. Making them citizens of the world rather than specific Americans of a particular time, place, and race. Schools had become, says Jones, behavioral engineering plants. They're going to get you to behave correctly, just as they got young Alex to behave correctly in Clockwork Orange by taping his eyelids open and forcing him to watch what they wanted and torturing him. Any system which does this much violence to human nature was bound to cause a reaction. Since the system was created for the social engineering of the immigrants who came to this country from southern and eastern Europe, it is not surprising that they would be in the forefront of the rebellion, nor is it surprising that the ethnic Brooklyn is where the rebellion first broke out. As the rest of the nation succumbed docilely to Rockefeller-sponsored social engineering, ethnic Brooklyn, i.e. the Brooklyn populated by Jews and Catholics during the Great Immigration Wave lasting from 1880 to 1920, resisted in ways characteristic of those two American ethnic groups. The Italians were the first to react when, quote, immigrant public schools in Manhattan began performing tonsillectomies and adenoidectomies in school without notifying the parents. The New York Times, June 29, 1906, reported that frantic Italians, many armed with stilettos, stormed three schools, attacking teachers and dragging children from the clutches of the true believers into whose hands they'd fallen. Isn't that amazing? So, in 1906, Italians are rising up against the public schools which are performing tonsillectomies and adenoidectomies. That is, ectomy means you cut it out. Cutting out their tonsils or their adenoids without notifying the parents. Unbelievable. In 1917, when William A. Wirt, W-I-R-T, attempted to implement his work-study-play school, otherwise known as the Gary Plan, he had previously implemented his system among the children of steelworkers in Gary, Indiana. That used to be a white place, now it's all black almost. Riots broke out in the Williamsburg and Brownsville sections of Brooklyn. Schools were stoned, police car tires slashed by demonstrators. 300 students were arrested, most of them Jewish. Mayor Hyland denounced the Gary Plan as, quote, a scheme, unquote, of the Rockefeller Foundation, by which the Rockefellers and their allies hoped to educate coming generations in the doctrine of contentment, which the mayor considered another name for social serfdom. Mayor Hyland denounced the plan and removed it from the city's schools, explaining that, quote, "The real menace to our republic is this invisible government. To depart from mere generalizations, let me say that at the head of this octopus are the Rockefeller Standard Oil interests," unquote. If phase one of Brooklyn's resistance was launched by frantic Italians, phase two was launched by the Jews. If phase one was more direct resistance, phase two was subversion. In the early 1950s, Stanley H. Kaplan, a graduate of City College of New York, who in spite of his good grades couldn't get a job, set up a small tutoring operation in a modest building in the Flatbush section of Brooklyn. Kaplan capitalized on Jewish educational aspirations at a time when the SAT had firmly established itself as the official rite of passage for entry into the colleges that granted access to the top positions in the American meritocracy. The WASP ruling class under Henry Chauncey's direction had created what it thought was an uncoachable test that measured pure mental ability. The Jew Kaplan was smart enough to see through WASP pretensions and came up with a system that guaranteed better test results. The system was so simple that it hardly qualifies as a system at all. In the days when the blueprint for building the atomic bomb was an open secret compared to the questions on the SAT test, Kaplan came up with a simple but ingenious way to subvert the system. After each class graduated from Kaplan's school and took the test, he would invite them back to celebrate with hot dogs and root beer. Admission to the party was gained by having each student tell Kaplan one question he remembered from taking the test. The net result of Kaplan's parties was a list of the questions that his students would face when taking SATs. If Kaplan tutored five classes of 50 students in 1 year, at the end of the year he had 250 questions. By the time Kaplan sold his test prep business to the Washington Post Company in the 1970s for $50 million, he had over 30 years' experience in gathering questions, which meant he could tell his students with increasing accuracy the answers to those questions as well. Jewish scores on the SATs rose accordingly, as did Jewish admission to the prestigious colleges that had established quotas to keep them out in the early 20th century. Actually, they were still admitted at about 10 times their numbers in the population, in the period in which they complained about being discriminated against. It is unlikely that people like Conant and Chauncey and Brigham considered Jews from Brooklyn the candidates most likely to fulfill Jefferson's ideal of the natural aristocrat, but they were the main beneficiaries of the system that Chauncey and Conant put in place to rescue nature's aristocrats from the rubble that the SAT was raking through in the period following World War II. So the Jews have more or less learned how to game the test, and that resulted in a rising number of them being admitted to these schools. The WASP faith in science, remember Jones is a Catholic and he is anti-WASP, based as it was on the idea of noblesse oblige, they had learned at schools like Groton, proved no match for clever Jews from Brooklyn who quickly filled the slots the WASPs had reserved for nature's aristocrats and the meritocracy. And they also did that by ethnic networking. Harvard University can now boast of a faculty and student body that is between 30% and 40% Jewish. The type of people that Carl Brigham thought his test would exclude because they weren't particularly intelligent ended up using his test to take over America's elite universities. The law of unintended consequences. Once that happened, it was only a matter of time before they took over American culture as well, something that occurred in the mid-70s. Just as opposition to the SATs was reaching a fever pitch. Perhaps the most visible Jew at Harvard is Alan Dershowitz, who grew up in Borough Park, Brooklyn, and is currently the world's foremost apologist for Zionism, torture, and the targeted assassination. Dershowitz was recently involved in a knockdown-drag-out fight with Norman Finkelstein, another Jew from Borough Park, when he waged a national publicity campaign to deny Finkelstein tenure at DePaul University in Chicago. Jewish subversion of the SATs continued throughout the 70s. Stanley Kaplan was a good vocal supporter of standardized aptitude testing, insisting that it promoted democratic leveling of the sort that both Jefferson and Conant would have approved of. Perhaps because of that fact, his subversion of the assumptions of the test makers was even more devastating to their scientific pretensions than those who challenged the intellectual assumptions that challenged its intellectual assumptions. Kaplan made the SAT look like a series of parlor tricks and word games rather than a gleaming instrument of scientific measurement, and it presented the test as a pitiless determiner of the individual worldly success or failure. As the 70s progressed, the subversion continued, but because ETS refused to acknowledge what was going on, they played into the hands of Jews like Kaplan and his successor, the founder of Princeton Review, John Katzman. By refusing to acknowledge that people like Kaplan and Katzman could in fact raise test scores by their coaching, ETS unwittingly allowed several generations of cheaters into the meritocracy. This was most certainly not what Conant and Chauncey had in mind when they began promoting the test, but intention is no match for the cunning of reason or the cunning of history, which has its own laws that function according to ways high above human intention. In 1977, David Halperin, a state senator from Brooklyn, introduced the New York State's Truth in Testing Bill because, as, quote, one of the striving Jewish boys tutored for the SAT by Stanley Kaplan, he felt that it was unfair that he not only recognized many of the questions, but also knew the answers to them when he took the SATs. Halperin's solution was to make the questions public, something which happened when the bill he co-sponsored was passed by the New York legislature. In doing that, Halperin effectively kicked over the secret ladder that had been used to subvert the tests and ensured that no one else who took the prep courses after 1977 would have the advantages that the Jews had had up until that time. If one person symbolized the Hegelian synthesis of Jewish and Italian resistance to WASP utopian educational schemes, it was Mario Savio, hero of the 1964 free speech movement at Berkeley. Savio was educated by the Christian Brothers in Queens, but his mind was formed by reading a slim book by a Jewish communist from Brooklyn. David Horowitz's seminal New Left track, Student, is what convinced Mario Savio to enroll at Berkeley in the first place. When Savio arrived at Berkeley, Clark Kerr, the chancellor of the University of California system, was at the height of his power. Kerr was inaugurated as president of the University of California in 1958, 1 year after Sputnik, at the height of the consolidation craze, with the two behemoths, America and the Soviet Union, locked in a titanic struggle for world dominance. Educators like Kerr and Conant were convinced that America's universities were the key to winning that struggle. Kerr was also convinced that education had become, quote, one of the principal means of vertical social mobility in the technical world, unquote. Kerr was convinced that, quote, universities today are at the vital center of society, unquote, and that they could give birth to, quote, a new era in the history of mankind, unquote, by training an elite of talent that would rule over the new technological complex, highly organized society, which was America in the 20th century. It was sentiments like this that landed Kerr on the cover of Time magazine shortly after Governor Pat Brown signed the master plan for California's universities on April 20th, 1960. As Lehman points out, Time magazine considered the headline Master Planner a great compliment at the time. Kerr was a wholehearted and sincere believer in the new democratic religion of education, because he himself had been raked out of the rubbish of Reading, Pennsylvania, high school, and sent off to Swarthmore College, where he converted to Quakerism, solely on the basis of the score he had achieved in an IQ test the high school had administered. When Mario Savio arrived at Berkeley, he realized that his generation, as well as the huge up-and-coming baby boomer generation behind him, saw things differently. After spending the summer of 1964 working for the overthrow of the apartheid regime in Mississippi, Berkeley's largely Jewish activists returned to put in practice the lessons they had learned down south. The children of Brooklyn were tired of social engineering masquerading as education, and responded dramatically when Savio took the podium on the steps of Spruill Hall and announced that there is a time when the operation of the machine becomes so odious, makes you so sick at heart, that you can't take part. You can't even passively take part, and you've got to put your bodies upon the gears and upon the wheels and upon the levers, upon all the apparatus, and you've got to make it stop. And remember, don't fold, spindle, or mutilate is one of the things he said. The students were tired of being treated as those little cards they used to shove into early computers. Tired of being socially engineered, which is legitimate, even though their agenda, their communist agenda, their civil rights communist takeover agenda was not legitimate. Savio articulated the misgivings of the generation that had grown up as guinea pigs in a massive but unacknowledged massive but unacknowledged experiment in education as social engineering, rather than education as respect for the person, as evidenced through the training of their intellectual faculties, their development, individual development of skills and practices, rather than training them rather than indoctrinating them and conditioning them to be cogs, showing some respect for the individual mind. What was the point of educational opportunity, this generation began wondering out loud, if all that it provided was the possibility of becoming a meaningless cog in an evil machine? That question haunted the consciousness of the baby boomers and begot another protest movement when most of that cohort reached the age when their children began to attend school in significant numbers. Homeschooling, which blossomed in the 80s, and which we've talked about here on Radio Stina before, provided the largest protest movement challenging the social engineering that public compulsory education had become. Only after a million homeschooling families and an equal number of religiously oriented private school families emerged from their sleep to reclaim their children from the government in the 1970s and 80s, in direct response to an epoch of flagrant social experimentation in government schools, did true belief find ruts in the road. And that's a quote from John Taylor Gatto. So, the free speech movement and the baby boomers began to wake up in the 60s, and this led to the rise of homeschooling in the 80s, or at least it was a strong driver of it. People tired of being treated as part of a social experiment rather than as independent, intelligent minds worthy of respect on their own. As if making the tacit admission that the school had become unreformable, the school system had become unreformable, millions of parents simply voted with their feet, as Lenin put it, and removed their children from the schools to educate them at home. The Jones family was part of that movement. With the last vestiges of the ethnic labor movement destroyed, the only group that baby boomers could rally was their own families, if they had families. Homeschooling reconstituted the social order according to its proper ontological order, which is to say, radiating out from the center rather than being imposed from the top down. The nation's professional educators noticed this as well. As one educator put it, homeschoolers are tremendously loyal as family members. They are suspicious of television and other less intimate influences. They eat as a family. They socialize as a family. They attend church as a family. They become members of an extended homeschooling community. And this is what actually gives rise to new nations, because there's something not only familial but tribal about it, as they seek to reclaim their lives and their minds, not just their minds but their entire lives, from the system, which is not just the school system, but it's all-encompassing. As Gatto said and we heard earlier, it encompasses everything. This kind of social engineering garbage is in every single institution of society. It comes from the government, the people running the government, the rich and the Jews. All of this brings us back to Langille and DiClemente's claim, and these are the guys who wrote Brooklyn Existentialism, which this article is a lengthy review of, that we've talked about, and this is the third show we've talked about it on, that we're concluding this discussion. Langille and DiClemente's claim that we, i.e. America's ethnics, just don't know our place. Just what is the place of the Catholic ethnic in American intellectual life? Just what is a Harvard education? As far as I can tell, says Jones, it is a tryout, or better, a tryout for a tryout, a tryout for a lifelong series of tryouts. After spending a lifetime peeling that onion, the Catholic ethnic learns that there is no kernel waiting for him at the end of his efforts. As WASP hero Bertrand Russell once said, it's turtles all the way down. When Adam was at Harvard, that's when Jones's older kid was at Harvard, he got invited to lunch by a member of the Porcellian, the most prestigious club at Harvard, the Harvard equivalent of Yale's Skull and Bones. During the course of the lunch, Adam was asked what he thought of Charles Darwin, and as a result of his answer, lost his chance to become a member of the Porcellian Club, which brings up the question, just what are Catholic ethnics allowed to say? Suppose you get into Harvard and you do well there. That allows you to go on to graduate school where your ideas will be more intensely vetted. If you succeed there, you may get a job at a university, in which case your ideas will get vetted even more rigorously. At that point, you may write the book, which will get you the tenure. And once you get the tenure, you will probably end up like Professor John McGreevy of Notre Dame, the man who did everything right, the man with a perfect resume. McGreevy landed at Notre Dame as a result of his book, Parish Boundaries, a book which made many good points, but in which McGreevy had to demonize his own people because of their failure to succumb graciously to the social engineering of their neighborhoods. And that is the destruction of the row house Catholics, or the ethnic parishes in the major cities, that Jones laments and describes in others of his books. The slaughter of the cities as being the prime example. But in which, okay, so McGreevy is a Catholic ethnic who does everything right. He goes up the ladder, and his ideas are increasingly vetted, but he writes a book, Parish Boundaries, that is good for the WASP because he denounces his own people and essentially criticizes them, as Jones says, for not exceeding gracefully and graciously in the destruction of their parishes as called for by the WASP/Jew agenda. In order to maintain that thesis, McGreevy had to suppress any curiosity he might have had about the role of Quakers in putting black residents in Catholic neighborhoods. Then, like the typical rock group of the 60s, McGreevy came out with a second album that bombed, American Freedom in the Catholic Church, was a tendentious and hastily put together plea for Catholic assimilation in America. In this book, McGreevy mentioned the Rockefeller-sponsored secret conferences on contraception, which took place at Notre Dame from 1963 to 1965, without mentioning the fact that the Rockefellers sponsored them. Something that struck me as similar to doing a remake of King Kong without the ape. When I brought this omission to his attention at a gathering of the leading lights of the American Catholic Historical Society, McGreevy opined that he omitted the Rockefeller funding connection from his narrative because, quote, it wasn't important, unquote. Important to whom? I suspect it was important to Professor McGreevy's career, which is why it got omitted from his narrative. In fact, the only way that Professor McGreevy can maintain his thesis that assimilation is good for American Catholics is by omitting details of this sort. The most devastating moment at the meeting already mentioned was when the professor from Harvard that McGreevy invited to praise his book dismissed it as condescendingly as a deeply aspirational book. So much for your aspirations, Professor McGreevy. Professor McGreevy's main aspiration was getting respect from the professor who dissed him. So don't expect any more books from Professor McGreevy, as if in tacit admission that what Catholics are allowed to say in America isn't worth a warm pitcher of spit. Professor McGreevy cashed in his career chips at the Notre Dame Casino and became the dean there during the 2007-2008 academic year. Dean's offices, in case you didn't know this, are where minds go to die. But the short writing career of Professor McGreevy as a Catholic intellectual brings up the further question, what is anyone allowed to say? What is the tattered remnant of the WASP ruling class allowed to say? What are Harvard professors allowed to say? John McGreevy was a professor at Harvard before he cast his lot with Notre Dame, the Realschule, where the Catholic bean counters and FBI agents get their marching orders. But he was Catholic, you say? Well, what about Professors Walt and Mearsheimer, certified members of the academic establishment who teach at Harvard and the Rockefeller-endowed University of Chicago? What are they allowed to say? What about Jimmy Carter, former president of the United States? What is he allowed to say? What about Norman Finkelstein, the Jewish pariah? What is he allowed to say? The answer to that question is anything that Alan Dershowitz finds acceptable. The answer to all of the other questions is anything powerful Jews find acceptable. But even that falls short by way of explanation because the American imperial juggernaut at this point in time is the closest thing the human mind has come to creating the perpetual motion machine. Jews most certainly are masters of discourse, as Israel Shamir claims, but the empire is a runaway locomotive with no one at the throttle. Think of public education for a moment, just one branch of the American empire. It is a juggernaut that has grown so big and powerful that no one is powerful enough to reform it. It has become a cancer in the American body politic and will only stop growing when the body nurturing it dies. This is John Taylor Gatto's verdict. Nicholas Lehman, whose political and cultural views differ dramatically from Gatto's, shares a similar sort of fatalism when it comes to the SATs. Lehman tells us that by 1990, which is around the time when Adam Jones was being felt out by a representative of the Porcellian, the SAT and the other ETS tests had worked their way deeply into the fabric, not just of higher education, but of the whole life of the American upper middle class, which was substantially oriented around trying to ensure that its children got high SAT scores and therefore berths in the better colleges. Stanley Kaplan and the Princeton Review and the other test prep courses, which comprised a substantial industry, were only part of it. Much of the curriculum in American elementary and secondary education had been reverse engineered to raise SAT scores. Even first graders were being drilled on the art of answering multiple choice reading comprehension questions. If SAT scores dropped in a particular community, real estate values would fall. The SAT had become a powerful totem. To the taker, it was a scientific numeric assignment of worth which, no matter how skeptical one tried to be about testing, lodged itself firmly into the mind, never to be forgotten. It symbolized access to higher education in a time when higher education was becoming synonymous with opportunity, just as the founders of the American meritocracy had hoped it would. So that describes the entrenchment of the SAT as excuse me, something that the middle classes have a great amount of faith in and the elite have a great amount of faith in. Lehman's solution to this problem is more of the same, more imperial supervision of the system that has already betrayed the trust of the nation's citizens by offering them the stone of social engineering when they ask for the bread of literacy. And really, that's what's at the bottom of this. Education is simply learning to read. Beyond that, you read what you want, and you can make it yourself the rest of the way. You just need to be taught the first tool, the simple tools. And that's all that education was ever intended to be and was among the people who founded America. And heck, back thousands of years, I mean, people had private tutors. The tutors had an interest in teaching them reality, not social engineering them, but raising them. You have to understand the difference between raised to be a part, a cog in someone else's machine, being systematically deprived of the intellectual tools you need to understand the world around you and your context in it, your place in it. Two very different things. One is based in respect for the person. The other is based in using the person to serve someone else's agenda. That's the bottom line there. Public schools exist to use your child for someone else's agenda. So Lehman's solution is more of the same. Since decent schooling, Lehman reasons, is the absolute prerequisite to a decent life in America today, it shouldn't be left up to local authorities to screw it up any more than flight safety should. But it wasn't local authorities who screwed it up in the first place. It was the centralizers, the consolidators, and the teachers of teachers who screwed it up. The master planners and the foundation people screwed it up. The local people were doing just fine. The local people, local education, produced the Jeffersons, the Calhouns, the Jacksons, the Washingtons, the Franklins. We are left here to infer that something that this important needs federal authorities to screw it up, says Jones. In this regard, Lehman continues blithely down the same path that has led to the problem in the first place. To get more people through college, we shall have to establish greater national authority over education. And this is the left's sempiternal solution. The eternal solution to everything is more federal control, more centralized control, when in fact what is needed is less control, local control. Very few things are actually matters that the federal government should be involved with. They primarily relate to collective self-defense. And yet, there's no self-defense when the nation is made up of various and sundry people from the sewers of the world. It's not a nation, so there is no self-defense. A nation must have a racial basis. High school should prepare their students for college by teaching them a nationally agreed upon curriculum. Again, that's Lehman recommending that. Those are Lehman's words, and, you know, again, they don't want you to have any local control over what your child is taught the way that you would in a home school or in a locally controlled public school. They want to dictate their agenda to you, and what is that going to include? Well, it's going to include elite or Jewish attitudes on every single political question, including the Holocaust. You're going to learn about the Holocaust. You're going to learn Jewish lies about what happened to their people during World War II. You're not going to hear anything about the Holodomor and what the Jews in the Soviet Union did to white people like you. You're going to hear lots about slaves and white guilt. You're never going to hear that Jews owned the slave ships and dominated the slave trade. All that will be kept from you. Your child will be taught to hate himself, hate his race, and wish that he had some kind of ethnic traditions like everybody else except white people. And that's not theorizing. That is what they teach. And that's why you don't want your child to go to a public school. So, like every other leftist, liberal, plutocrat, Jew, Lehman wants a national curriculum. Who will set the national curriculum? Well, of course, a bunch of Jews in Washington, D.C. will. Through the Education Department. From the Education Department will come the writer's guidelines that are used by the four or five publishers that provide books to the educational market. And the writer's guidelines are these multiple dozens of page guidelines that to a very, very particular degree determine how people shall be characterized. It's just astonishing. There's a book by a Jew, actually, Diane Ravitch, if you want to read, I can't remember the title of it, but it goes into this in pretty good detail. Maybe I'll get that book and we'll talk about that on one of these shows. But it talks about how carefully the curriculum followed in schools are detailed by the controllers. The question reminds us of the maxim of all vocations directors: reject the first 10 people who apply. Who, one is tempted to ask, would be willing to waste his time attempting to come up with a nationally agreed upon curriculum other than the villains who have created the mess it is supposed to remedy? Should Planned Parenthood have its say in designing it? Will the nationally agreed upon curriculum contain instructions on how to put a condom over a banana? What about the NEA? Having input into something this utopian is probably the only thing that would tempt them to get their front hooves out of the feeding trough. And how will a nationally agreed upon curriculum deal with ethnic diversity? Will the Amish be forced to take courses in auto mechanics? The answer to that question is yes, because that is precisely what happened when James Bryant Conant orchestrated the last nationally agreed upon curriculum, otherwise known as school consolidation. No, says Jones, neo-Taylorism for the schools, that is time and efficiency management applied to the schools, is an idea whose time has come and gone. What we need now is what might be called the Brooklyn solution to our problems. We need fewer grandiose utopian schemes and more wisdom from the stoop, explaining to us how all true culture is simultaneously universal and local and ethnic. We need more students at more places like St. Francis College in Brooklyn reading antidotes to bad ideas like Brooklyn existentialism, who upon graduation will return to the communities which have nurtured them so that they can, in turn, nurture the next generation of Brooklynites. During America's Civil War, Brooklyn soldiers had their own distinctive uniforms. It's high time places like Brooklyn started wearing their own uniforms again. This is not a foreign idea. It corresponds to the original American conception of itself before the WASP ruling class betrayed the ideal of its forebears and sold the rest of us, the progeny of cheap labor, down the river to build their empire. And he's referring to America being originally a collection of different nation states that came together to form a weak federal government simply in order to protect themselves, not in line with utopian designs. I'll take a little break here, then we'll come back and we'll finish this article. We're almost done.
The branch of the linden is leafy and green. The Rhine gives its gold to the sea. But somewhere a glory of it's unseen. Tomorrow belongs to me. As a whisper
China.
Your ship of a pleasure to see. The morning will come when the world is mine. Tomorrow belongs. Tomorrow belongs. Tomorrow belongs to me. Oh, mother and father and sons of thine. Your children are waiting to see. The morning will come when the world is mine. Tomorrow belongs. Tomorrow belongs. Tomorrow belongs to me. Tomorrow belongs. Tomorrow belongs. Tomorrow belongs to me.
¿Sigues creyendo que les pararéis los pies?
Outside, a black spider dancing on top of his eye. Red-legged chicken stands ready to strike. And everything empty in into eyes. Built my house from barley rice, green pepper walls and water ice. And everything empty in into one.
Thank you.
dotted line, and you fill me in with whatever you like. I'm just going through the motions. I need no fasting potion. There gotta be some old recipe. 'Cause I gotta get drunk, I gotta forget about some things. I'll see better days, but I'm not so sure I will. I'm still hanging round and round. Sometimes it's a racket, but lately not a sound. In the mouth of history and time, I have learned to stand back and never shine. And now I feel stupid when I smile. Not a journey, but a circus are our lives. Everything I waste, and I know that I could never afford a taste of anything that your lovely hands make. It eats away with a force so great. Is it 'cause it brings a smile to my face? This is a bad memory you just can't erase. I know of a city to steal from, and I know of a city on, and I know of a city of sin, and that's the place that I want to meet you in. Sail all over again, romance me, take me back to the beginning.
All right, that was Cabaret, song from Cabaret, Tomorrow Belongs to Me, followed by Cat Stevens, Into White, and then Art Isn't Real from Deer Tick. And we played some of their songs before. We're going to conclude now the last bit of this review of Brooklyn Existentialism. And I'll be with you again next week, next Tuesday. Probably have a longer show at that point. I'm a little rushed today, so I'm have to cut this one off a little over an hour. But, like I said, well, let's finish and then I'll get back to the internal matters. Now, Jones was saying that the WASP elite turned its back on itself, essentially, because the people who created the country were products of local schooling and private schooling, tutoring, and now, after a couple hundred years, we've kind of worked our way back to that. We see the rise of homeschooling, where there are 2 to 4 million homeschooled children out of a body of 48 to 50 million children of K-12 age. And this is because, regardless of to what level intellectually they understand it, they get the general idea that their children are being treated as cogs rather than treated with respect, and that social engineering is the new purpose of modern education. It has been for the last 100 years, and they don't want any part of that. And when they go their own way, why it turns out that teaching the basics to kids is, I think Gatto says somewhere, it only takes like 100 hours of education to teach people the basics of reading, writing, and arithmetic. And from there, once you have those basic tools, you can pretty much go on and do your own thing and find out where to go yourself for real additional training. So we've kind of worked our way back around, and it's the purpose of this show to teach you what's going on and also to encourage you along the lines that are best for you, yourself, your children, your family, and your people. And that certainly includes avoiding public schools that train your kid to hate himself and to become part, become a cog in this new world order machine, this system. Jones says, Jones, a Catholic, says, this is not a foreign idea. It corresponds to the original American conception of itself before the WASP ruling class betrayed the ideal of its forebears and sold the rest of us, the progeny of cheap labor, down the river to build their empire. That empire, like the Roman Empire before it, is condemned to fall under the weight of its own wretched excess. The defeat of the forces of the neocon puppet Saakashvili in Georgia is a sign that the American-Israeli Empire has reached its fullest extent and is now in the process of receding or collapsing. Empires tend to dissolve quickly when they go. Carol Quigley, Bill Clinton's teacher at Georgetown, foresaw this moment decades ago. The fundamental, all-pervasive cause of world instability, he told his students when they invited him back for one last lecture, is the destruction of communities by the commercialization of all human relationships and the resulting neuroses and psychoses therefrom. Let's repeat that. Now, this is the guy, what was his, he wrote some book called, like, Hope and Promise, something like that. This is the, Georgetown is university in Washington, D.C., and they are famous for their international relations department and their school of what is it, strategic studies, whatever. Anyway, they train a lot of these people to go on to become diplomats, what have you. Bill Clinton went there. Well, anyway, Carol Quigley was the professor who wrote a 1,000-page book. It's quite readable, actually, although I've only read a few hundred pages of it. But in that book, he describes a new world order that Cecil Rhodes and the WASPs, the Anglos, the people who founded the British Empire, were trying to create. And that ideology is still regnant among America's WASP class. And it coexists, I guess, more or less happily with the Jews, who are the new power in America today. And so Quigley taught people like George or Bill Clinton back in the 60s. And what Quigley said in his book, or what he said to his students when they invited him back for one last lecture, was the destruction of communities. He says the fundamental, all-pervasive cause of world instability is the destruction of communities by the commercialization of all human relationships. And Georgetown's a Catholic university. I guess Jones is saying this is a Catholic idea, that when it's one thing for a baseball player to be a free agent or a football player to be a free agent and look for the highest recompensation for his services, but when you treat all human relations like that, when you're always looking to trade up, and when you have a society that conditions you that way and teaches you that that's the right way to do things, as Jew mass TV and the educational system do, then you get the what Jones calls neuroses and psychoses, because nothing is stable. No human relationship extends beyond the desire of it's like at will. It's like at will employment. You can be fired or you can quit, depending on whether it's in your interest. But if that principles, if the principles of the market are applied to human relations, you get great problems. And that's what Quigley is saying. And he was someone who supported this idea of a new world order. Drawing on his Catholic roots, Quigley saw hope because out of the dark age that followed the collapse of the Carolingian Empire came the most magnificent thing. The recognition that people can have a society without having a state. Think about that. The whole idea of the state, we have all these crises that are invented by the government for which it provides a solution, but its solutions don't work. I mean, I posted, we have a subforum, Scams. I posted in there stuff from Sardi, who's a doctor who writes a lot about how bogus, you know, the FDA and government involvement in the medical market is, and how bogus a lot of all this stuff is that's supposed to protect us and serve us and save us and make us safe. Well, really, it's about control. Ordinary, common people outside of a system can do better for themselves than they can in a giant state in which all serve as slaves for the government. And that's how it increasingly is in America. Almost everything is a function of the state, and very little exists purely outside of it. And that needs to change. And it's pretty amazing that someone like Quigley, who'd supported a New World Order, as far as I know, he wasn't opposed to the New World Order proposed and acted on by Cecil Rhodes that he describes in his book. I can't remember the title of his damn book. Just Triumph and Tragedy, or what's the name of his book? Let me look that up. Tragedy and Hope, that's the name of his book. Isn't the internet beautiful? The point here is that he says that people discovered they could have a society without a state. Society is the natural human relations that grow organically out of families forming local communities, versus the state is something that's imposed top down by a tiny concentrated elite who wants to use you and your kind and kin for their benefit. So this is kind of a libertarian understanding there, that you can have a society without a state. What happened when Rome fell can happen again when the American Empire follows it into the dustbin of history, says Jones. The ethnics will realize that they have no power to save the empire, even if they wanted to, but they do have the power to be true to each other and form communities that will help them weather the coming storms. That's a very pregnant sentence for white nationalists. What he's saying is that the elite may have the power, and they may be able to bring in these foreigners and disrupt and destroy our communities, but at least at the family level, we can stick together and form networks that can survive the problems created for us and the damage caused to us by these tiny, hostile, alien, predatory, parasitic elite, whether WASP or Jew. And that's a good message. I might even reflect that message in our coming paper. From inside the heart of the establishment, a Catholic professor found his voice and had the courage to articulate the Brooklyn alternative, the one St. Benedict had articulated when the Roman Empire collapsed, the one Quigley articulated at his last hurrah at Georgetown. Quote, "The final result is that the American people will ultimately opt out of the system. We are already copping out of military service on a wholesale basis. We are already copping out of voting on a large-scale basis. People are also copping out by refusing to pay attention to newspapers or what is going on in the world, and by increasing emphasis on the growth of localism, what is happening in their own neighborhoods. When Rome fell, the Christian answer was, create our own communities." And that has to be the white nationalist answer also. We don't have the power to destroy the federal government, but the federal government is destroying itself. We have to bear some of the pain of that, though. But nevertheless, we must do what we can and soldier on. Then he says, "Is Sam Jones what Thomas Jefferson had in mind when he advocated raking through the rubbish? Is he what James Bryant Conant had in mind when he asked Henry Chauncey to develop a test that would bring the talented Midwesterners to Harvard? As of this writing, Sam Jones plans to pursue a career in dance." And he has a photo of his son. And the caption reads, "Sam Jones performing in Leo Delibes' ballet Coppelia with Kelly Yap." And it... a picture of what appears to be a fairly serious dance recital or ballet or something. Anyway, very interesting article. Encourage you, if you're of a mind, particularly if you're Catholic, you want to support Culture Wars, subscribe to their magazine and go to culturewars.com. And this, of course, is an unpaid, unsolicited prompting on my part, simply because I find value in what Jones writes. Although I don't agree with him on many things, or on many things we disagree. He is a Catholic. I am a white nationist or nationalist. And I respect biology. He respects religion. Let's leave it there for today. As we said, I'm Alex Linder. This is Radio Istina. Istina being the opposite of Pravda, the noble truth, or the ideological lie. Istina being the gritty factual reality. of the situation. This show is broadcast live on Tuesdays from govnn.com, or you can also access it from vnnforum.com, which is a forum we encourage you to join. It's for whites looking for an answer to the political and social problems that besiege us in 2008, with a black president and a Jew-controlled government. And as I said, we are going to put out a new print paper. We've done several of them in the past, but we haven't done one for over a year. But we are going to do one now. I encourage you to join and become part of that super cheap price to buy a few hundred copies and distribute them to let people know what's actually going on. Again, I'm Alex Linder. I want to thank you for listening today. I'll be back with you next Tuesday. And I think what I'm going to do now is play... Or what I'm going to do later tonight, I'll probably put the radio back on and play an hour or two of music. Maybe I'll play the new Guns N' Roses album for those of you who haven't heard it yet, Chinese Democracy. So look for that either today or later tonight or maybe tomorrow afternoon. Just depends. With that, we'll shut down. Thanks for listening.